Hello, this is the podcast for September 27, and it's class number 10. And I felt it was necessary for us to kind of backtrack from last class a little bit, because, as I said at the end of the last podcast, I felt that I had rushed us unnecessarily through the duty of owner-occupier, and I didn't think that was a fair, good idea. So I wanted to backtrack. So we spent the first part of class today talking about the classifications, and I said before that I didn't want you to learn the classifications. Well, that was wrong. Of course I do. I just don't want you to get crazy about the minutiae involved in the classifications, the status categories, because they're very fact specific. It could go this way, it could go that way. In terms of establishing duty, the important thing to recognize is that probably half the jurisdictions still have different responsibilities of landlord and of owner-occupiers, and we call those duties, different duties of care depending upon the status of the individual who has been injured by not an activity on the property, but some sort of condition of the property. And that's important to recall. Even in the jurisdictions like New York and California that have eliminated the categories and have one standard of reasonable care for any entrant upon a property who's injured by a condition on the property, the status of that entrant still is plays a role in determining what's reasonable care. The issue is that the status in the jurisdictions that have eliminated the categories, the classifications, the status of the injured party becomes important at the reasonable care stage, whereas for the jurisdictions that have retained the classifications, the status is important at the initial duty inquiry. So many cases can be discharged under a summary judgment motion at the duty stage, so it doesn't even get to the breach question, if the court determines that the status of the entrant, the injured party, meant that the owner-occupier did not have a duty to them. So it's important that you think about at what point does the status become important. It becomes important for those classification jurisdictions, the traditional jurisdictions, at the duty spot, doesn't even get to the jury, whereas the jurisdictions that have eliminated the strict duty requirements depending upon the status, the classification jurisdictions, or no classification jurisdictions, I'll call them, the status of the entrant is still important, but it becomes important at the reasonable care. So for those jurisdictions like New York, California, the dozen or so that have eliminated all of the classifications, the likelihood of it's most likely that they will, once it's been determined that a real injury did take place caused by a condition on somebody's property, it will go to the jury. It's not going to be there's not going to be a decision that there's no duty, because the duty is always going to be of reasonable care. So it's really more of a role into the jury. Why do they not eliminate the status requirements or the classifications, because a lot of jurisdictions haven't, about half of them. Well, they must feel that there is still a role to play. You don't want to send everything to the jury. You don't want to, if you're a social host, you don't want to put more of a requirement on those people than you would on a business enterprise, for example. So, a lot of courts have considered it and retained it. I always think that the more modern view is the elimination, but it certainly isn't the case. So I think I'd overstated it before. If there's any question like on an exam or anything, I will say this court, how you should talk about it, this court retains the common law class, status classification, or this court follows the Roland v. Christian, Basso v. Miller line. And I'll tell you what to consider. So then we started talking about the duty of a landlord or duty of a owner-occupier for criminal activity on their property, not because of conditions on the property, that there was a sinkhole or a defective floor or anything like that, but criminal activity. And I wanted to make the analogy between this, the Randy v. Mira case, the Tarasoff case, all of those other things that we placed a responsibility on people for criminal activity, that is, the injuries created by a third party, and those responsibilities were based on knowledge and control, knowledge that there was a danger, ability to control the third party. Similarly, the courts have placed a duty on owners and occupiers to prevent criminal activity when they have, basically based on the control factor, that the best ones to control it, when there's been a foreseeable, when the crime is foreseeable, and the term foreseeable is a real, it's a term that we've been seeing over and over again, and we will see it used significantly when we talk about proximate cause. But foreseeability is not an expansive term. I think you have to, I want to caution you about this. It's not, conceivably foreseeable that you would do this. It's reasonably foreseeable. Foreseeability is not an expansive term. In fact, it's a limiting term. So your duty to prevent criminal activity on the property is when it's reasonably foreseeable. Foreseeability isn't all that it creates a duty. Remember, it was foreseeable that Matasar was going to beat up Epstein. That didn't make a duty for me. I had no ability to control Matasar, and I had no duty to Epstein. So foreseeability in and of itself is not enough. But in terms of the property owner and occupier, their relationship to the property, their ability to make the property safe, plus the foreseeability that there's the need to, creates this duty. Now, we saw in Posakai that the court does adopt, it was a case of first impression in Louisiana, does adopt a foreseeability standard, but identifying how do you define foreseeability was the real issue at this case. And they talked about various ways to assign foreseeability. They didn't want to make it too narrow, that you had to foresee this specific action or this range of specific actions. They didn't want it to be too broad, which is look at the totality of the circumstances. They made foreseeability a balancing test. How likely is it that something would happen, and how burdensome would it be for you to take precautions so that it doesn't happen? Now, where did we see that before? Balancing tests, we saw it before in Carol Towing. So that's sort of a tip-off. But in Carol Towing, foreseeability, this balancing test wasn't used to create a duty. It was used to set the standard of care. Question I had to ask you, what's the difference here between balancing to create a duty and balancing for standard of care? Can you balance it so that there's a duty created, but that the standard of care isn't automatically breached? And I think that the court in this case may have merged the two. And it's important that you, when you're doing your analysis, that you keep duty and breach separate. Don't mush them together. That's inappropriate. We talked a lot about the variety of crimes, criminal activity on property that have been coming up. It's a huge area of litigation, particularly hotels, security, parking lots late at night, all of that kind of stuff. Lots of, you're attacked, you're beaten up, you're raped, you've had a robbery. Who's going to be responsible for it? And, the whole issue is here, putting a burden on a property owner that it's ordinarily a police matter. When do you turn property owners into police? And it's important to remember, even if you do, that the owner-occupier is not the insurer of safety. All they have to do is behave reasonably. Every criminal activity is not going to mean liability. They just have to behave reasonably. And then we moved over to talking about intra-family liability, that is familial immunity. And very frequently this is seen not as a duty question, but as a defense immune from lawsuit. But I think in the scheme of things, and we're talking, it's best to consider it at the initial stage rather than at the duty stage rather than waiting for it as a defense. And the court does talk about if you're immune, that means no liability. So don't even go through the liability issue. Immunity comes as an initial question. We've seen traditional reasons for immunity and disturbing the family and all of those. And then we looked at the modern basis for having no immunity. One of the big reasons is the existence of insurance. Without homeowners liability insurance, there would be no such suits. It's the only way to reach these insurance through the liability policies of the homeowner's insurance. So the insurance is there in order to get it. It has to be gone through one of these, a suit such as this. So, and we did discuss, it's so prejudicial, the existence of insurance, just as the existence of the fact that somebody would be a wealthy person, that the existence of insurance doesn't get to the jury. Although I think these days most jurors are savvy enough to think about if you're there, there's got to be some reason that litigation is going on. In reality, the most personal liability defense is done by insurance companies. They're the ones who are trying to protect their assets. So what you do is you turn over your case to the insurance company. You don't care. It's not coming out of your pocket if you're the defendant. And let the insurance company, they indemnify you, and then they have the ability to get the assets back through contribution. They sue for the assets back from the plaintiff. Again, we looked at reasons for eliminating the parental immunity for negligent supervision cases, and why courts may still continue with the immunity. New York is one of the jurisdictions that does not allow negligent supervision, still parental immunity. Why? Because the standard, if you eliminate parental immunity and go into a reasonable parent standard, courts say that's not their job. They can't possibly, no jury could reach an agreement on what's a reasonable parent. So New York follows what the Goler case in Arizona did, which is immunity for decision for things that involve parental discretion, no immunity for things that would involve duty to the world at large. So driving, being a pedestrian, all of those activities that a parent may, if you're pushing baby carriage or carrying your baby, you're driving with your baby in the car, you still have a duty to the world, and so no immunity for those things. But things that involve parental discretion, who you allow your child to play with, what you allow your child to do, the child is injured while you're in the other room, all of those things, New York has still retained parental immunity. No possibility of suing for negligent supervision under those cases. Okay, next class. Now we're going to start with governmental immunity. We're sort of continuing the immunity theme. And governmental immunity is a very, very large and important section. And I want you to pay very, very close attention to these cases. There are three main cases, but along there in the note cases, in note C, is the Cuffey case. On note C on page 235, it's an important case. I wish it was a main case, but consider it as a main case, and we will read the Cuffey case also and discuss that in class on Wednesday.